Mr. Mason, Reel 3. Now, I'm not quite sure of the dates of this. You were at the reception centre. We'll just do a bit of tidying up. The reception centre, you got there in January. You were there till...
Well, I'm probably... it may have been later, because when I think... I would probably have a fortnight's leave on transfer. And then... go to the reception centre, so that would probably be later in January.
January to February.
The first of January was when I was transferred. But how long, I can't remember how long that took to us. It could have been February by the time I got to Stratford. And then if we say March, ITW could have been longer, say March, April, ITW, and then I finished up at Perth in May. I was flying in May, so I probably went to Perth at the beginning of May.
Right, so I think that's where we'll start then. Now, the Perth, what was the that was... Number 11, EFTS, that stands for...
Elementary Flying Training School, and that was at Perth, that was run by Airwork, a civilian organisation. We were billeted in Scone.
Scone?
Yes.
Just outside Perth?
Just outside Perth.
What were the billets like?
Quite good. They were, well, certainly... an improvement on sort of army conditions, and as I remember, they were very comfortable. I can't remember what we were in, but we must have been in some public building. And there, of course, we were introduced to tiger moths and given elementary training.
Now, you were on dual instruction in the tiger moth. That was what you were there to do, wasn't it?
Yes.
So you started about halfway through, 19th of May. We've got your logbook in front of us. Yeah. Flying Officer Hurst seems to have been your pilot.
He was
your trainer. And this went on for nearly a month of dual. Yeah. What do you remember of dual training in the flight in the Tiger Moth? How did they take you through it step by step?
Well, you started off and had... a sort of fly round as air experience, and then
was that your first flight?
That would be your first flight.
What did you think of it?
Quite enjoyed it. It was very enjoyable, and it was something you've been looking forward to, obviously, for a long time.
Did he stunt you, or was it just a flight?
No, you just fly around.
So he wasn't trying to shake you about?
No, just give you the feel of it. Then you would start and do an instruction probably about half an hour at a time, where he would take off and then let you get the feel of things and fly it around, and then he'd land it. Then you would get to the stage where he'd ask you to take off, and when he felt safe, he'd ask you to land. I don't think I ever had any thought that I was going to be a pilot. I still wasn't intending to be, really.
If you'd passed the course, would you have done it?
I would have had to, yes. But
did you never feel you were going to... Did you have a natural... I mean, some people are natural pilots.
No. I was very good at landing. I could land perfectly. But I used to swing on takeoff. And this was what I used to upset him, rather.
What do you mean, swing on takeoff? Just explain it for me.
Well, when you open up the engine, you've got torque on the propeller, so it tends to... And so you've got to keep the aircraft straight. And I used to have a tendency to wobble a bit.
Waver,
yes.
So you'd correct it and then swing too far.
And he wasn't too happy. And you've got to remember that at that time, I had driven a car, but only on an odd occasion. You weren't used to mechanical contrivances, and this was a new experience. And I think at any EFTS, the people that stood out were the people that had been driving sports cars or motorbikes, or, you know, and were, if you hadn't done this, all of a sudden you were put in something and you were shooting across an aerodrome at 80 miles an hour and taking off and being carried along in a way that you'd never previously experienced. So that I can't say I ever felt I was going to make a great pilot. I enjoyed it, but got to sort of halfway through the course, and I was on the borderline. And in our ground training, we'd started doing navigation and such like. And after the exams, halfway through the course, I came top of the navigation exam, and myself and the fellow that came second were asked, you know, did we really want to go on, or what about being observers? To which I again said, well, that's what I really wanted to do in the first place.
Was there any sort of, I mean, did you regret it in any way?
No. I never any wish, really, to be a pilot. It was not.
Did you ever do any solo flights?
No.
So you were taken off?
No, this fellow was very chary about letting me loose. He was afraid I might go all around the aerodrome, wrecking everything.
Your logbook sort of changes gear, and in July, you switched to flying in ensigns.
Yes.
And it all starts air experience and then map reading.
Yes.
This is when you're on an observer's course.
This is where I went to. I was flying at Perth until the last one was 10th of June, and then this fellow Neville Atkinson and myself, we went down to Babbacombe, which was another ITW, so that we could go from there with their next intake, as it were, going to observer school. And so there I am in July at number 2 Air Observer School, Milham, in Cumberland.
Now, did anything happen at Babbacombe? Or is that,
nothing, because we weren't doing any. We had nothing to do. We were there for a couple of weeks, doing nothing, until presumably their current course ended and they were sending some people off to observer school, and we
Now, what was the setup of the observer school? Can you describe the air school, how it was set up at Milham, and in fact can you describe the Milham base if you can?
Well, Milham, which is now an open prison, I'm not sure whether it's open. It became a prison. Milham is on the bit of land jutting down into the Irish Sea, very sandy, and they were a hutted camp, fairly comfortable. The instructors were either tour expired navigators or wounded navigators, observers, I should say, and a number of the people running the courses were ex merchant marine, captains or mates who were teaching navigation. And the observer course included a whole load of things. So they had a variety of aircraft. They had the main aircraft there were Blackburn Bothas, which were ex-coastal aircraft, which were not considered suitable for operation.
It's not a well-known plane there. Can you describe the Blackburn Bothas? What was it? What did it look like? What did it, I mean, they can see a picture, but what was it like inside the rest of it?
Well, I thought it was a very good aeroplane, but they equipped two squadrons, or tried to equip two coastal squadrons, but it didn't fly on one engine. And of course, for flying over the sea, that is most unwise. And so they were all sent off to observer schools for training. And they were, well, a sort of medium high wing monoplane, two engines, perspex nose with a navigator's position down there, Astro hatch, and a Fraser Nash turret with a couple of guns in. And in the navigator's compartment, you had windows which sort of jutted out so that you had a very good vision. And they were quite good aircraft as long as the engines kept going. I mean, while we were there, one did have an engine go on takeoff, and you know, about all you could see afterwards was the ends of the wings and the tail. It went so deep into the ground, it was unbelievable.
And what about the Anson? Is that the Avro Anson?
Yes, they'd also got Ansons, which were used for navigation exercises, and they had a few Oxfords, which were...
What did you think of the come to the Oxford? What did you think of the Anson?
Oh, the Anson was you know very easy really. It flew very comfortably, and you could walk about in it very easily, and it was.
It would fly on one engine, would it?
It would fly on one engine. Yes, it was safer than the Potter.
And the Oxford, which firm made that?
That's the Airspeed Oxford. They were used mainly for communications, but I think they had a few really because they were available, and probably were used for map reading more than anything else. So.
Now, they took you up first for air experience, which I presume was not particularly of note.
Well, yes, I mean, it's when you do your air experience, you're really flying around so you can see where the aerodrome is and you can spot the local landmarks and so on, and it's really gives you a bit of local knowledge so that you can find your way back again.
And then... From the first week in August, you started on map reading. Had you had ground? Did you do a lot of navigational training on the ground first?
Yes.
What navigational training did you get on the ground? That would be important to know.
Well, you did your basic DR navigation.
DR.
Where you took a chart and you drew a line between two places. And were given a wind, and so you worked out your course, and then you were given.
Now, how would you do these? Can you explain these things in a bit more detail? Because people don't know how that works.
Well, you had a Mercator's chart, and a Mercator's chart, which is you probably know, is where the ground is represented. Flat and everything, latitude and longitude are set out as rectangles, but it has the disadvantage the further you go north, the more the landmass is expanded, so that although it's very suitable for navigation,
it's not suitable if you wanted to fly a long distance, because it's throwing you out. But for the normal distance, the Mercator's is the navigational chart, because everything is right angles, and so you would start off by doing simple dry swims, flights on the chart in the classroom, where you would be fed information to find your position from and check your wind and
now, how would you find your position?
Well, you would be given wireless bearings, for example, which you would then plot, and that would show you where you were, and you would then by measuring your course and speed, you could then work out what the wind was, and you would, of course, from the position, know what your track was. And so you would... you basically had to learn to do the work out the things you need. The track and speed, you know, because the speed, the airspeed indicator tells you, and the track is the line you want to do. You then have to know what the wind is, to know what course to fly, and having worked out your course, you then know what your ground speed is, and the whole thing is dependent on knowing what the wind is. And this you find out by taking your track, your course and speed, and finding a pinpoint of where you are, and from where you are on your course, you can see where you are on your track, and the difference is what the wind has done to you. So you can then work out the wind speed and direction. It's, you know, the simple triangle of velocities.
And any other what other navigational training would you get?
Well, if we have a look, I think now if we look at the things, there's DR navigation.
Now, what is DR? Explain that.
Which
DR
is what I've just been talking about.
The DR stands for
dead reckoning. Compasses.
So what was it to learn about compasses?
How to correct them, and how they worked. Meteorology. Maps and charts.
Meteorology. What were you learning about that?
Oh, so that you could read a weather map and tell what, so that you would be able to work out what the wind is and might be. So you could anticipate what was going to happen. Maps and charts, which is instruments, which is airspeed indicator, altimeter, which means basically how they worked and what errors there were likely to be in them. Reconnaissance. Now, don't ask me what that means, because I can't remember. But I imagine it's basically what to look for, what to do, or what. Photography, how to use the camera and take photographs from the air. Practical work, well, that would be the charts from the actual navigation exercises. DFWT, direction finding, wireless transmission. You were on an observer course. You were supposed to be able to use the wireless, and you had to know Morse code.
When did you learn that?
Well, they are here at observer school. This is the difference between when they later changed the brevet to navigators. The navigators course didn't include quite as much as the observer's course. astro navigation, how to navigate by the stars. You're supposed to know 36 stars, I think. And that that is the list of ground subjects you did. Air subjects, apart from navigation, you also did gunnery, in which you used the turret in the Bother.
Now, tell me about that. Which turret was it, and how did you operate?
Well, it was a Fraser-Nash turret, which
Fraser-Nash,
which operated rather like bicycle handles. You sort of had a handle to turn it around. They had two guns. They cut off so you couldn't shoot the tail off. And
what guns were they?
Brownings. And you had a target aircraft come up with a drogue and try to make holes in it.
Did they teach you things like deflection shooting?
You were supposed to do it properly.
How did you do it then? Was it one of your...
Well, I passed. Then the comment is keen but needs experience. I see that they were 25% hits on my exercises, so they presumably didn't think that was all that good.
What other air subjects?
Sorry?
What other air subjects?
Bombing. Or as to your other. I see I dropped altogether 68 bombs, good Lord.
And what were the skills you were learning there?
Well, to use the bomb sight, bomb aiming, basically. And, of course, you also, on gunnery, on the ground, you learnt the Lewis and the Vickers, although by then they were out of date as actual use in aircraft. Apart from in Hudson's, for example, we used to shove Lewis guns out of the side windows, so, you know.
So the bombing was, what sort of exercises would you have? I mean, what height, what sort of bombs?
Well, there'd be 10-pound practice bombs, which used to drop and show a bit of smoke, and, you know, you had a target out in the sea with a couple of watchtowers on the land, which took readings on where the bombs dropped relative to the target.
What other air subjects?
Sorry?
What other air subjects?
No, well, that's all, really.
Gunnery and bombing?
Gunnery, navigation, gunnery and bombing.
Well, in what way was the navigation in the air different? You know, well, that was practical, what you'd learned.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, there, you see, you... normally, two navigators would go at the same time. And you take it in turns to be first navigator or second navigator. You would both do it, but the first navigator was responsible. You know, he was the one the pilot was taking notice of, and the second navigator just sort of followed behind.
And so you took turns in each of those.
Yes, yes. And that went on.
Were there any incidents or anything you remember from your training?
Not particularly. As I say, one of the other course, the course ahead of us, one of their bothers went in. We lost one pod on the course, and Anson had to ditch in the Irish Sea, and one of them didn't get out of it. But apart from that, the only other exciting thing was one of the sergeant instructors on the on gunnery had a Lewis gun jam, and he said it's always doing this or worse than that, and walked in front of it and kicked the cocking handle back with his foot and shot himself in the stomach, which wasn't good for the pupils, really. But apart from that, it was fairly uneventful.
So you were there until December?
Yes. Now, of course, at the end of that course, they decided whether you were going to be commissioned or made a sergeant or whatever. And at the end of the course, I was told that I was selected for a commission, and I'd had to go and see the station commander was away, so we saw the wing commander in charge of the observer school, and it was very strange because there were 8 of us, I think, went up, and we were interviewed on the morning after Pearl Harbor. So as we waited, we said, we bet the first question he's going to ask is, what's going to happen now, Pearl Harbor? So we had a short debate on the subject, and sure enough, it was the first question he asked, and so he got some jolly good answers.
And what was the interview like? What was he doing? I mean, you'd been picked. What was the interview for?
Well, really, you had to be interviewed for somebody to decide that you were suitable. But it was very much just a quick check, really. I had, in fact, when I was told first, I said, well, I don't know whether I want a commission. And they said, well, it doesn't matter whether you want one, we've decided you ought to have one. And
well, why did you have doubts about taking a commission?
Well, I didn't feel happy about going along to a squadron because at that time there were not many commissioned observers. They'd only just begun to commission observers. And I was not happy at the thought of going to a squadron with a commission and a whole host of sergeants looking at me and thinking, well, you know, he doesn't know anything about it.